Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Welcome to Connoisseurs, a regular show by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Halee Lee, the owner of The Other Media Group.
Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the ArtsUS Center for the African Diaspora.
Marianne Combs, arts reporter here at Minnesota Public Radio News.
Luz Maria Frias, a race equity consultant and executive coach.
And Don couldn't be with us today, so we have a very special guest sitting in with us.
Beverly Bushyhead of Bushyhead Consulting.
Welcome. So I'm really excited about this topic, you guys. I'm giddy about this. The new Netflix film, Always Be My Maybe. And I was super excited to see this, not only because I'm a 90s child, but because it's written by, directed by, and the majority of the cast were Asian Americans, and it was hilarious. Very formulaic if you're talking about romantic comedies, but I liked this better than any other romantic comedy I've seen.
I don't know if I get quite with you on that one, but what struck out for me is we are in a situation now where we're norming a whole lot of different ways and of being and showing up Asian. What I liked about this is the home normalcy of it, right? What stuck out to me most is my wife and I have been trying to find representations, you know, in films and media and things like that of Black folks. It's not solely specifically for the purposes of being Black and showing Blackness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We definitely want Blackness to be a part of it, but that there's a normalcy to it of everyday living that norms Black experiences beyond kind of just what we assume Black folks should be day in and day out, right? I mean, you don't get all the way away from tropes, Asian tropes in this space, but it just felt normal and natural in its course. And so we were able to view it with some understanding of the richness of some of the cultural things that were happening in there, but mostly just as a funny, hilarious film with really, really funny comedians.
Well, and being able to have that normalization / representation helps to hopefully educate, for lack of a better word, our various audiences that an Asian character doesn't always have to play a certain role to be successful. So that normalization that, guess what, Asians can be very successful in whatever role they choose. I think about, 20 years ago, I was involved in a local initiative about representation in the media. And I kept driving home, look, don't come talk to me as a Latina only for Cinco de Mayo once a year. Because guess what? I exist 24/7, 365 days a year. So come talk to me about snow blowing or mowing the lawn. I mean, that's that normalization that we're talking about, is not pigeonholing ourselves or allowing the media or someone else to define us as one-dimensional.
Let's hear a scene that sort of exemplifies a little bit about the movie and what it does. Early on, there is a scene in Always Be My Maybe where it's going back to their childhood. And so you have Sasha, who's Chinese-American, going next door to her best friend's family's house, and they're Korean-American. And here's just a scene that happens in the kitchen.
Look at that. Doesn't that look amazing?
It looks super amazing.
Kimchi jjigae is very simple. But that's what makes it so good. It's about using the best ingredients.
It smells so good, Mrs. Kim.
Sasha, I've told you a million times, call me Judy. And we Koreans use scissors for everything. Vegetables, noodles.
Our children.
You want to check?
Okay.
Look at you, you're a natural.
Thanks, Judy.
Are you sure you're not Korean?
So there you have an example of just a Korean-American family and Chinese-American kid hanging out together.
So I'm very interested in why you chose that clip.
It was actually me who chose that clip. And part of the reason is the intersectionality here of the cross-cultural representation that was happening between a Chinese-American family and a Korean family. Since then, I've shared it with my Korean friends who asked me that same question. They were like, okay, that's cute, but that wasn't necessarily something that stood out to them as a marker of Korean identity. In fact, it was actually quite a marker for my Korean friends of an assimilated Korean identity which I thought was very interesting and stuck. It was one of those awkward conversations, another podcast that we've done in interracial relations.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. It's a whole lot around who nurtures, who takes care, what's mm-hmm. a woman's traditional role. You know what I mean? What's expected of you. And so it kind of led into that female kind of gender role thing, I thought. Mm-hmm. So I found it interesting that culture was brought into that at an intersection where there's several things happening there. Mm-hmm. And I just found it very interesting, too, about why that was picked as a clip.
I just thought, and maybe it's because I'm a filmmaker myself, mm-hmm. but I was like, they had to at some point explain what each kid was.
Hmm.
She's Chinese and he's Korean.
So you're saying we read too deep into this one little scene?
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, that for me, I was just like, it's really funny that they felt like they had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it makes them smart because they know their audience and that people are probably going to be wondering throughout, like, so what are they, Chinese? What are they, Japanese? You know, and having them just establish it at the beginning, we're Korean. Are you sure you're not Korean? And it's like, oh, yeah, so she's not Korean, and he is. All right, I got it. If you're thinking, though, if this was a different movie, it was Drew Barrymore and some other person, right? Some white guy. Oh, my God, I can't think of a white guy.
Adam Sandler.
Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler. There you go. And they had this similar scene where he'd say something like, oh, in my Italian family, this is how we do it. Would you think the same thing?
I would, because it was about who nourishes who. She was leaving an empty home to go next door to receive nourishment and familial kind of, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A normal kind of growing up with this family. And later that's revisited in a different scene where he's mm-hmm. like, yeah, you ate our food. You were at our home because your parents weren't there.
Right. So exactly. That's how I saw it, as part of the storyline, not so much as making a statement mm-hmm. about Asian families mm-hmm. or Asian cultures, but because it has so much to do with what happens later in the movie.
Well, there's one important piece of it here, and it comes later in that same clip, is the father. We see an Asian father in this case, the character Marcus, his dad. And we see an Asian father different than we've seen in movie. I can't think of any movie right? where we've seen an Asian father this interactive,
affectionate, expressive.
All these pieces that are not typically what you see in the stereotypical Asian father's role. So I see in movies that have been out there, at mm-hmm. least that have been big enough to get into my space. That means right. there's a whole lot of movies I haven't seen, of course. But I thought that was a very important piece. So in the lack of representation, a whole lot of things seem like they're so much more significant than they are to folks who actually live in that community. And that's something right. that we see over and over again whenever we review films that are made by and from the perspectives of people in those communities.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you. When we're coming from a ethnic background, particularly an immigrant family, the pressure to assimilate is there. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the film and we learn about Sasha, who is the protagonist in the film, and how her family is unavailable, you know, you start asking questions about why are they so unavailable? Is it because they're trying to assimilate, or is it because of financial necessity that they have no other options to do that, you know, and the family support system isn't there. Sasha's only recourse is to go next door. She's not being met by other family members, which would be pretty unusual, I would say, in my community, in the Latino community, when we're talking about a similar situation where both parents are unavailable to tend to the child coming home from school.
See, I felt like that was something that is very common. You know, you go to an Asian grocery store, you go to an Asian deli, it's one family and they're there all the time. And so I liked how in the film they said, we're at the shop or we're at the store, mm-hmm. make yourself dinner, but they didn't specify. So it didn't pigeonhole us into like, oh yeah, we're at the Chinese restaurant that mm-hmm. we run down the street.
Right.
Versus something that happens a lot in Asian families, in entrepreneurial Asian families, is that we own a store, we own an establishment, and we're the only ones that work it. So we have to be there during all these business hours.
There's a simple thing happening here too, because going right next door, you can see just in the interaction how easy it is for her to go next door and hang out with Marcus's family. There's still a communal care aspect here that's going on, where it may be physically home alone in this scenario piece, but that doesn't mean I'm unwatched. right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm uncared for. I'm unconnected to a bunch of folks who could step in. And we see this later on when Sasha's at her goddaughter's family. And she's kind of mad because her parents seem to be all of a sudden giving all this attention and love in their retirement to this kid, for this kid's birthday party. And she feels a little some kind of way about that. But she's not mm-hmm. unconnected to all the mm-hmm. rest of her family members and mm-hmm. other folks in community. And so, to me, there's that piece, too, that's in the mix as well.
You know, I think it's also just important to remember this is a really funny film, too. We've gone sort of deep and heavy already, but there's great comedy in this show. And there are a lot of instances where sort of the culture is laughing at itself. You know, these are silly things that our dads do. And so there's another scene. You know, we have the kids, Marcus and Sasha. They've now grown up. Sasha's gone off and become a major restaurant owner. And
world famous,
you know,
gourmet chef.
Yeah. And Marcus, meanwhile, has stayed around. He's got a band. He takes care of his dad, but he hasn't really gone much far in life. And so he's actually helping his dad install air conditioners. And what do you know? They end up at her house in San Francisco. Here's an excerpt.
If you're renting, then why are you installing AC?
No way! Sasha Trent!
Mr. Kim, oh my God!
Oh, look at you!
You have not changed one bit. How do you not age?
I washed my face with shampoo. I can't believe I'm seeing you. We thought you'd never come back. You're like our own Asian Oprah.
Oh.
How much money do you have now?
He's serious.
Well, what I love about that is you got to remember the writers of this film, right? And so Ali Wong and Randall Park are the writers of this, right? What I could rely on is that the jokes that are here are the jokes that we see when they're in their stand-up and they're talking about their experience. And so the asking of how much money do you make, I'm sitting there going on the couch going, did he just not look over my wife? And she's like, yep. And your grandmother would do the same thing. And so there's this interesting, you know, kind of a cultural connection piece where it might not have been asked the same way, but it's those things you're just like, ah, yes, we do that.
So I'm interested in why you chose this clip.
I chose this clip partly for the absence of swear words.
Fair, fair, fair.
We have a high bar for journalism, my dear.
But also the dad character was so much fun, and to see him interacting with Ali Wong's character with Sasha was always just really fun and just a lively moment. So I thought it was an engaging moment with the two of them. What do you think?
I was like, okay, when I saw that, and that wasn't all the previews and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, the trailers and stuff, but I was like, she would have known he was serious.
Oh.
You know, but they had to have Randall Park's character say it for folks who aren't in community mm-hmm. who wouldn't know that. But like literally, like she would have known he was serious when he asked that.
When you make a film like this, you always have to have one foot in what you say to your community that they understand, needs mm-hmm. no explanation. And we've mm-hmm. talked about that in previous podcasts. But when you're dealing with multiracial audiences, having to put things in to explain what folks outside of community don't necessarily see, you know, making those choices have to be real difficult because, you know, you do that too much and you run the risk of being real authentic to home community.
Yeah.
You don't do it enough. You risk being able to give folks a tidbit to stay with you.
Right. There has to be enough of a in-between spot where you're making enough jokes that we're like, okay, she's authentic, and not being like, oh, they whitewashed it.
So did that experience, those lines, take away from the film experience for you?
And maybe as a filmmaker, again, like I see like, oh, I see how they have to put that in there mm-hmm. for the viewer. So I'm probably viewing all this stuff from a very different perspective than most people.
I was surprised by the dad's comment to Sasha's comment about not aging. But the first thing that came to my mind when Sasha made a comment about, gosh, you know, you haven't aged, is a saying, Asian don't raisin, mm-hmm. you know, mm. and how the equivalent of that is Black don't crack, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was expecting, because
Beverly, I'm seeing you shaking your head.
I never heard any of these.
Because
oh, really?
Since Ali Wong is a comedian, yeah. I expected that to come out, and it didn't. It left me wondering why, and I'm sure there's a good reason, but I was thinking, at what point are they going to leverage some of what's kind of that inside narrative within the Asian community and elevate it out so that people who have never heard it, like you, Beverly, would understand that.
I think also his response was so Asian in that he washes his face with shampoo, so he thinks it's like magic. And it's just like a random thing that probably has nothing really to do with his aging. That's an Asian parent thing. They'll be like, oh, so this worked for so-and-so, so you got to try it. And it's like random.
This reminded me of My Big Fat Greek Wedding with the Windex. And yes, how in that movie, like, the father is like, Windex is good for everything. You have a cut on your finger. I'll put some Windex in it.
But that one has proof of concept at the end because it actually works. In it.
In my community, it would be Vicks VapoRub.
Oh, yeah. We use it for everything. We use it for everything.
My group of friends, we get together for a friend's dinner every Monday, and it just rotates to a different house. And this is where we get to put all the things on the table and see how our different communities pop out together. And one of the things that comes up very often is we sit around and talk about all the old, like, cultural myths that are within community that you end up talking about, and they aren't grounded in anything logical when you zoom all the way out and think about it. But it's something that we just do, like turn off all the lights when it's a thunderstorm outside. That's a real Black community thing. My aunts would be like, hey, shut off all the lights, there's a storm outside and there's lightning. That's not a thing, but it is in so many different places that it just becomes part of what you do. And it's funny to kind of sit back and laugh at some of those things.
It makes me think, again, who the audience is for this movie. And I would have loved to be in the room with Ali Wong when she had to adjust what she would have said just normally, what she would have said to her community, and then how she had to adjust for the audience that obviously clearly keeps coming up.
Yeah. From a gender point of view, I thought it was really valuable for the protagonist being a woman and being independent and financially successful and breaking kind of all the barriers, if you will, of these cultural expectations, right? Which is the opposite, is that Asian women, you know, need to be dependent on the male in the household in terms of their identity, their career, kind of subjugated, you know, to their success, if you will, financially and otherwise. And I like that they completely flipped that script, literally, to have her be the protagonist and centered on her success and independence and her not caring about marriage or children or all of these traditional cultural expectations that are antiquated and that present a tension in modern day lives for us all.
I don't think that's exactly true, because don't you remember she was with that guy who was seen as way more successful than her, professionally than her, and she was kind of like eating dirt to be with him. She made that decision in the middle of that loss.
Although I felt that, I grant some of that too, but I felt that there was a tension the whole time, and you could see the tension that she was having, and I think she was trying to straddle both cultures at one time, and it wasn't until after it ended that she
made her peace with
that. Made her peace with that, and then, you know, became her own. And really owned her space as a woman in this. I mean, because she pretty much could have stayed, you know. I mean, we don't want to give away the whole movie, but I mean, you know, it could have gone
she
the
made
other
the
way.
Decision to break up with,
yeah,
with the guy
she made
at
a choice.
She's like, at the beginning.
Yeah.
Another thing I really enjoyed about this movie that was like out of the norm was the way that Randall Park's character was just kind of this guy who smokes weed, hangs out at home, has this like, you know, has this kind of hip hop rock band kind of thing. And it's like nobody, if I told somebody I'm going to go see a hip hop rock band with some stoner dude I know, nobody would assume it was like an Asian dude.
I think there's a whole lot of breaking of what we usually see out of Asian male characters, if we see them at all. But also I think it connects to something that you brought up around the role of Asian males and how they're viewed and looked and held up. And Ali Wong actually talks about that. You know, there's a scene where her and Randall have it out. They start putting stuff on the table. And she makes a comment about, you know, you would never have to worry about some of the things I have to worry about because, you know, you're a male. And so I think there's some calling out of some things. I think they're more subtle than you might do if you were actually writing this for just an Asian community, which is another one of those things, to your point, Beverly, about where she turns the dial. I think there's a couple of things in there that only because of having this conversations, Lee, that were on my radar that I think would have been a place where I would have stepped on the gas if I'm in community. And then for the film, you know, it's dialed back and done a little bit more subtly.
And also, I think it's important to point out that she has three romantic interests over the course of this movie, and they're all Asian American men. And can we just talk about Keanu Reeves and just how hilarious he is?
Oh, he's a Pacific Islander, but yes.
I was about to call it out. Like, right, I don't know where that falls. Right. It's not for me to say.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's not for me to say, like, I would consider him part of the API community, but a lot of Polynesian folks do not like being referred to as Asian. So I just...
Okay.
You
know, so there's some intersection pieces there.
Yeah.
What I like about the exchange, though, is really what happens with Marcus's character in response, right? And this one's actually comes from the promo scene. This is fair. It's no spoilers here. But in the promos, you get to see the interaction there, and you get to see, again, a male character, a male agent character, have to go up against somebody, and it's not a kung fu battle because neither one of them fight very crafty at all, and it's just hilarious. And so I was like, oh no, Keanu Reeves is gonna do some John Wick kung fu stuff, and it's gonna be something like that. And then, you know, you forget for a second what the writers are, because you have PTSD from previous movies involving Asian folks. Right. And instead it happens in the most hilarious way that you just, it's just love it. And it's another break from the tropes that we see all the time.
That was my favorite. I've enjoyed Keanu Reeves in the past, but I have to say there are a lot of roles I've not appreciated him in. It was Keanu Reeves playing Keanu Reeves, and I loved it. He was hilarious.
That entry when he came in that scene is all over social media right now.
Yeah.
There's memes, and it's viral. It's everywhere right now. People love that.
And the story that's coming out a lot with this film, too, because it has been so successful. It's really good. It's funny, and Keanu he kind of steals the show a little bit. But just to talk about how everybody's saying, oh, Keanu is so down to earth, or Ali Wong is such a real person. And the talk about how, you know, these people aren't Hollywood-y at all is like the big thing that's coming out about this. And I'm like, I don't know if that surprises me to the point where I'm like, oh, that's really great that they're not a bunch of like snooty people. Or if I'm just like, yeah, duh. That's, you know.
Well, I mean, but those conversations are exactly why this movie and others that are changing the game around representation matter. Because now you have something that's breaking and normalizing a whole lot of different ways of being who we are. Folks are losing their appetite for the same traditional stereotypical roles.
So if we think about it, if we, you know, kind of take a 30,000 foot level, media has played a critical role, a central role in creating the narrative for all of us. And that narrative has relied squarely on tropes, you know. Mm-hmm. Birth of a Nation, you know, we talked about that. That film that everyone points to in the civil rights movement began to really vilify black men and define men as a threat, you know, to white women and to society. Media has had such a critical role in defining and stereotyping all of our communities of color and indigenous community that it's about time, 120 plus years later, that we are now seeing a turn. It's a slight turn. It's not a complete pivot by any means, but certainly something that is long overdue, and helping then reframe how our communities of color, indigenous communities, are viewed in mainstream America, and quite honestly, across each other communities as well. Mm-hmm. In 2019, we will now have a total of 13 films and TV shows combined that will feature and center Latinx community and characters and storylines, which is unheard of. But I think a big part of this also has to do with the demographic shift in our country, which really has filmmakers and these networks understand the power of our presence, but also the necessity of the money that goes with it.
Mm-hmm. So my favorite scene in the movie, Always Be My Maybe, comes during the birthday party scene. And you see two little girls come in at the front door. They take their shoes off. They pick their shoes up. They run all the way to the back door and put their shoes back on and goes outside. And I was just like, that is so real. But my question for you guys is, you know, this is on a streaming network. This didn't get the money or publicity that like a blockbuster movie in the theaters would get. And I feel like Netflix has done that with a couple of shows and a couple of different movies. And is it just because they're the ones willing to take a, quote, risk? Are we a risk to be taken? Or how do you feel about that?
You know, Netflix has a different formula. So a blockbuster film has to meet certain criteria in order to make the money, to have the production, all those kinds of things. Netflix has a different formula. They say, you know, if it's something's going to draw any community to the stream, all I need to do is put stuff into the stream that'll pull those folks. And so instead of having a one-time, you know, breakout pull and draw of folks, all I need to do is think about a continuous stream that pulls in a whole lot of different folks. And so that formula allows for different things to be made. That's one part of it. The second part of it for me, you have folks and writers who are now taking things to Netflix and saying, hey, here's this idea because of the way that they're set up, gets to say, let's go try that out. If something doesn't get enough streams on there, I just pull it from the stream and keep it moving. Mm-hmm. And so there's a different formula that allows for a little bit more diversity in storytelling in that way.
Yeah, I would build on that by adding that Netflix, it's my understanding, based on my reading, allows for more creativity and direction from the artists themselves that allows them to be more hands-on than a mainstream major film production company would. So by way of an example, to illustrate that further, is Coachella, which is, you know, really Beychella, right? For Beyonce, who it's reported that Beyonce drew a very small salary from going to Coachella. Her goal was to film it and create this documentary type of film from that, and made a deal with Netflix early on, before the concert even occurred, that this was going to be her baby and she was going to get it filmed in her way and with her voice, and then ended up netting over $60 million. Yeah. I mean, so that's a type of creativity that a streaming service such as Netflix and perhaps, you know, Hulu also is in the game, that allows an artist to have more of that control and ownership.
You're talking about Beyonce's Homecoming?
That's right.
Yeah.
Does that mean we'll be seeing hopefully more from our communities then, right?
And there's quite a few projects that are in the works because of doors that are opened by, you know, so we will understate Always Be My Maybe just by calling it a really fun, you know, romantic comedy. It's actually opening the door for the success of a whole lot of other things to be there.
You're listening to Counter Stories on NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Luz Maria Frias, Beverly Bushyhead, Halle Lee, and Anthony Galloway. We're going to continue this conversation and shift to a different show. You're listening to Counter Stories on NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, along with our co-hosts, Luz Maria Frias, Halle Lee, Anthony Galloway, and our guest this hour, Beverly Bushyhead. Thanks for joining us.
There's been a lot of things that have come out on Netflix that are telling true stories historically and really correcting some things in there. There's a show called Pose. There's a show that's looking at the ballroom culture in the LGBTQ community, particularly around transgendered folks. And then Ava DuVernay's new show,
When They See Us.
These opportunities are allowing us to go into a whole lot of different places, not just representation in terms of normalizing everyday life with an Asian couple in a romantic experience and changing some of those tropes there. But then Ava DuVernay comes out with When They See Us. I keep saying how, the way they, all of these are things that have been written. So just so you know, that title in and of itself is connected to Black literary pantheon. So there's a whole lot of different poems and stories about it.
I think the frustrating thing for Native people is much of the movie that has accuracy and that is represented by Native actors come out of Canada. Mm. And so unless there's some high-profile actor who tells the story in a white savior way, mm-hmm. it doesn't make it in Hollywood. So you had to look for alternatives like Netflix or Hulu or other alternatives so that you could tell a story.
Right. If I didn't know that Randall Park was co-writer, I'd be like, oh, of course it's Randall Park. He's the only like Asian actor out there right now. Right?
Right? You know what I mean? So some of that tokenism happens, and then it just sort of, for me, spoils it.
Are those Canadian films making it into those streams?
They're not making it in the streams, but through the Sundance Film Festival and through other ways, they get in. But otherwise, they wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have that power. And so I wondered if Ali Wong digged that so that now the next time she can go straight to the power. You know, I don't know. But it's been really a long time coming, and it's very difficult in my culture.
To that point, one of the things that comes out of folks in communities telling those stories is some of them are going to be the lighter things. And some of those are going to be the visceral mm-hmm. things that are right true to the heart of the community that are hard to watch. And when you're talking about big box, you know, films in movies and for theaters versus what Netflix can do is Netflix gets to tell a much more raw story that you can pause, put down. And When They See Us is an example of that. It is hard to watch.
So yeah, I started watching like the first 10 minutes of the first episode, and I got a text from Anthony who said it was really, really hard to watch. And me being the optimist that I am, you all know that, I was like, I can't watch this because I'm just gonna like go dig myself into a hole. And so I was really interested to hear you guys' perspective, especially Luz, because you're the one who suggested this, and then saying you had to take a couple of days off.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about just what it's about first before we dive into
sure.
that?
I got you.
So When They See Us is a film by Ava DuVernay, which documents and details the experience in a film way. So it's a narrative film of that calls out the experience of the Central Park Six, the boys who were rounded up amongst many boys in New York after the rape of a jogger in Central Park that drew, you know, widespread national attention. And they villainized these boys very much like the Scottsboro boys were villainized back in the early 20th century and put these boys in jail. And they recently came out if they were exonerated because the whole thing was done very inappropriately and based on a whole lot of stereotype that everybody fed into from the media to our current sitting president.
Now, you said the Central Park Six. I've always heard it referred to as the Central Park Five.
Five. Yes, I'm sorry. And there's a reason that I keep going to that. There's the Jenna Six. There is the Scottsboro Boys where it whittled down to, again, six boys. And so there's all these different stories. The Central Park Five are not a new example of black boys being rounded up for something that they didn't do and made to be villainized for the sake of the country. So there's a whole lot of these things mixing in my brain.
Let's hear a clip from the show. This is when those kids have first been rounded up and are sitting in a classroom.
What happened to that one?
Bunch of wise asses out in the park last night, hassling bicyclists, beating up people. Only 13, 14 at most. Parents coming in for family court tickets.
That's wilding.
What's that?
You said on your report here they were wilding. What's that mean?
I don't know. One of them said it.
So you were just going to let possible witnesses to a rape go on a family court ticket? Wake these kids up and start getting some information. We've got a lady raped and clinging to life here.
I want their interviews on my desk immediately so I can put together a timeline. Let's work.
So she refers to that in that clip as wilding instead of wiling, which is what you say in community. And the she that I'm referring to is this prosecutor. She has since resigned because now her case, which ignored a whole lot of folks trying to poke holes in the case that she was building, and she railroaded it through writing all these different narratives of who these boys are, now has just being discredited because of all the stuff that she did trying to make this case happen and really convict these boys. And so we have Ava DuVernay here calling that out. And so, again, when we come back to the idea of representation, we have a Netflix film that is putting this truth back onto the table and forcing now retribution for all these wrongdoings in the past, right? So Netflix is also becoming this space for truth-telling in ways that we didn't have before.
And this is just me. Whenever I watch a movie that's, quote, based on a true story, I always go back and I review the story that what actually happened with. And so how is this movie, if you guys know, like accurate as far as the facts go?
It's my understanding is it's very accurate, you know, and that the writers worked with the actual gentleman, the Central Park Five, in pulling this together. And there's so many aspects of this, and without spoiling the movie, I want to just share my impression. When I first tuned in last week when it launched, I think 20 minutes into it, I had to turn it off. I was just so disturbed by so many elements of their 13 and 14-year-old boys who are being coerced physically and verbally by police officers to create a narrative that fits within what they've already, the police and the prosecutor, have predetermined to be the reason and the truth, so to speak. And I couldn't come back to the film for about 3-4 days. because the trauma that it was coming up for me watching this. And of course, being trained as an attorney and seeing all the things that were just in violation of laws, the police interrogating 13 and 14 year old boys without an adult present, for one, let alone an attorney. And there was just, you know, example after an example, the inconsistency of the boys trying to tell their truth, and then the police then making sure that the only way the boys understood that they could walk out of that room after being detained for hours without seeing their families, without being fed, without, you know, the basic necessities of life, so to speak, extended to them, was to lie. And if you think about, as a parent, I think I put myself in that situation and seeing what that would be for my children, even though my children are grown now. There were so many feelings that came to be, and also the realization that while the movement for Black Lives has centered on police brutality in the streets, the police brutality also exists and has existed and continues to exist within the police four walls and the station as well. And really, the enormity of that, the weight of that, feeling that in the first 20 minutes, I had to walk away.
There's a scene where John Leguizamo, who plays one of the parents of one of the boys, comes in, and the officers began to like scold him for being late. Where were you? Why weren't you here earlier? And he's like, I couldn't be released from work. You know, there's this dual assumption that I know there's a place that he shouldn't be, but I also know it's a place that nothing should happen to him. And so right. If I have to make the decision of all the things that are happening now, I'm going to finish my shift and get right over there. So I haven't slept. I haven't done any of these things, you know, in support of my son. And you see that slowly, you know, the helplessness that starts to pass as you get later on. There's also a point in there where, again, coming back to the media representation piece, there were whole media campaigns to vilify these kids. I mean, that can't be lost. A whole bunch of media jumped on the bandwagon that was being written largely by this prosecutor and some of the folks in and around this are trying to steamroll this through because somebody has to account. There's even a scene where the boys are just being apprehended, right? So when you talk about brutality, there's a scene where the brutality isn't just the physical harm, but the brutality is how we're treated from the parent who walks in, how we're treated by the story that's being written and then co-signed by media at the same time. But that brutality starts from the moment I start investigating and interrogating you for who you are and whether or not you should be here. And there's a scene where the boys are first rounded up and you start to see that brutality, which I put as part of this, start.
Hey, you got ID? Huh?
Yeah. Huh? Only ID I have is my bus pass.
Well, let's see it.
Fits a description.
Yep, Yusuf Salam. 16. What, in 11th grade?
Yeah. I'm actually 15.
We graduate high school next year, you're telling me you're 15?
He's give some grace. And I changed the birth date on that.
How come?
Just trying to impress some girls.
We'll go with 16.
So, sorry, there's a lot here, which is why it's so hard to watch. But here is somebody in community who's graduating early, who is a genius, right? Who's doing all these things forward. And the moment I encounter you, none of that matters. And this is part of the brutality of this particular systematic thing, that no matter how much good you've done, no matter how much success you've had, in this moment, you are reduced to a suspicious actor who has to assume this role just to try to get out of something.
He's being stripped of his humanity.
Right now,
I mean,
moment.
As a young man, he is telling police who he is, and instead, his humanity is stripped by police, and he's being, you know, stereotyped into a thug because that's what the police wants to believe. And his comment about he fits a description, they had no description.
Right.
So I'm thinking about the fact that we have these stories that we've all mentioned are so hard to watch. And the obvious value of telling them because we're adding light to a story that was never fully told the first time. And as you said, Anthony, that there's been retribution as a result, that you're seeing consequences now because this story is being told. But it's also really hard, and in some ways, I think, re-traumatizing for some people to see it, even as it's educating others. And how do you sort of weigh the positives and negatives of putting that out there for people? I mean, I know they even had a counselor on set for the actors who were working on this.
There is, and you can talk to folks much more, you know, versed than us, you know, Dr. Resma.
Menekin
is, you know, has talked about this quite a bit, but there's a difference, right? It's hard for me, not because of what's in the film specifically, but because of the life experiences that I have had that get called up. So let's be clear, whether I'm watching this film and the expertise of it, an expert way that it's done, or I'm reading the news clip or the myriad of other things that come in there, that's going to happen regardless. In this space, there's a distance that you can make because of the film, but it's still calling up some things in a visceral way. And so it's not the same as what I see in the videos that come out of unarmed killings of black men, right? There's a different type of trauma, and it lives in different places in the body, according to, you know, Dr. Menekin. And so one of the things that I have to do is take this in the bite-sized chunks that I have, but I'm also in my community telling stories and sitting through stories is healing. And you have to be able to tell those stories or you never really get to a point of starting to heal. So I'm going to finish it. That doesn't mean it's any less hard, right? And so I think there's a difference in this space in terms of re-traumatizing. What really re-traumatizes me is the reality of life that still happens in there. The fictional retelling of a very hard and real story doesn't register in the same trauma tank, for lack of a more eloquent word.
And I would add to it in a different way from the standpoint of I've read some pieces about folks saying, you know, why now? Why are you telling this story? And they were exonerated, so what's the big deal? And I want to point to a piece that was done, a report that was done by the National Registry of Exonerations, which was published last year, that indicated through this research, it has a database of all known false convictions in the U.S. dating back to 1989. For 2,265 exonerees, the database showed that the exonerees, while in prison, served a combined total of over 20,000 years behind bars. 20,080 years behind bars, served by folks who were convicted falsely. And you think about how detrimental that is to our community, to our nation, and the cost they had looked at, the impact it has financially between the lawsuits and the state statutes that award for wrongful convictions, and over $2.2 billion has been paid out as a result of that. But when you dig deeper and kind of disaggregate the way we usually do on our program, you learn that the settlements for white wrongly convicted defendants is substantially higher than the settlements and the awards for black convicted, falsely convicted individuals. And that's present in light of the fact that there are more blacks being wrongly convicted than whites, you know, so the disparities continue, the injustice continues, and this is why we need to be reminded of what the truth is and connect the dots, so to speak, so that people begin to understand the impact it's having in our society.
I think one of the things that pulls out, I'm sorry, Beverly, I know
you're
trying
to jump in. Well, I was just going to say, it's happening now, this whole Philando case and this Justine, the Australian woman that was killed, the whole retribution, the whole recompensation of how that loss was valued in dollars is hugely another traumatization to all of the community, I think. So,
and there are these huge gaps. I think, you know, when we talk about across communities, one of the things that this film also raises is the extent to which folks are riding in charge of this woman who was raped in Central Park. Meanwhile, black and native women across the country are missing at alarming rates, are raped without any energy being put into finding the perpetrators in ways that are just unfathomable. And what this film also does, in addition to just telling the truth of this story, is to pull out the really deep disparity that exists between the rule of law and the prosecution of bad actors in our society in one community versus another.
For me, what I'm taking away from this is that, A, the power of being the storyteller, the fact that you have Ava DuVernay, you have Ali Wong, telling these stories, and how that changes the lens, changes what stories are told on the big screen. So that's one version of storytelling. Then there's also, you were talking earlier, Anthony, about the how media vilified the Central Park Five. Mm-hmm. So there's also the storytelling of the media and what happens on a daily basis, and how we're still working at diversifying who's telling our stories, who's investigating, who's covering major news stories of the day. So the call for greater diversity within both, and seeing the, you know, the consequences, the results that can happen once you have that diversity, is really powerful.
And also, I mean, just talking about diversity in Hollywood, diversity in the newsroom, you know, it took a couple of Asian folks to make this film happen. It took a black woman to make this happen. Yep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to take a Native person to make the stories happen for you guys. You know, this is, that's just the way it is. And so when people say, well, anybody can just make a movie, right? Like, oh, what's the big deal that the director was white, or, you know, this and this and that? It is a big deal, because it lends itself to the authenticity and what it means for the community. And my only hope going forward kind of is that, you know, this, I mean, right now, if you think about it, diversity and inclusion is really popular. It's kind of a buzzword. People are doing that. And all, everybody was so happy that Crazy Rich Asians came out. I was too, but then it was like, oh, I don't want these studios to start thinking like, if we do this, then we're going to get some really good publicity about, oh yeah, we're so diverse that we made this show.
Right, we've checked that box. We're
right,
good.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully this kind of entertainment, this kind of history telling, this kind of truth telling continues in our streaming services and in theaters. And we'll see more.
Beverly, to your point earlier, though, we have to really start thinking about our streams. Even though Netflix is providing another avenue for some things to get through, to your earlier point, we got to go to Canadian streams in order to find some of the authentic storytellers and Native communities that are really putting some of those things out there. And so one of the challenges that we still have is, what venues can we find already telling these stories? Mm-hmm. And how do we reach out and get in connection with those streams?
Absolutely. And elevating them.
Right.
Because, I mean, yesterday, the Canadian Prime Minister admitted all of that evidence added up to genocide. He had to use the word publicly. After how long? I'm not using it.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, where do you go, Beverly, for films that represent you? That, you know, where do you seek them out? What's the easiest place to find them?
So lots of things are independent. And that's where I seek a lot of my news and a lot of my information out, and then being networking and community.
The hard thing is, as a filmmaker, I'll tell you, like, you know, we all want to tell our stories, and we all have such deep stories and stories that you don't hear, but we also have to pay the mortgage and we have children. And so it's really hard when you're not a big Hollywood name to be able to do this in a way that can reach a lot of people. And so at the same time of, like, you know, all this great stuff we're saying about this happening, there's so much that is being left off the table just because we don't have the funds or the access to make it happen.
That's why social media is very equalizing. It's a great lever.
And I would close by just reminding us all that there's power in us stepping into a space and demanding more from these production companies, whether it's mainstream production, you know, big Hollywood production companies, or Netflix or Hulu, and ask for more. And as me as a Latina, asking Hulu or Netflix, why am I not seeing the content from indigenous communities? I want to see that. And likewise, you know, pushing that voice out and letting them know that there is an appetite, a hunger, a demand for that to happen, and pushing them to be outside their comfort zone.
I have an idea for a show called Real Girls, not like the girls that HBO had, bunch of white girls living in New York City and living it up, but like based on like my life and my interracial friends and kind of how our life would be. I'm like, That would be like, it would be so real.
I'd watch the mess out of that show.
Right? All right. Y'all hit me up for that. In the meantime, I hope you guys will join us next time. This is Counter Stories, a show by people of color for people of color. I'm Halili.
Anthony Galloway.
Marianne Combs.
Luz Maria Frias.
And specially here, Beverly Bushyhead.